So how do you get these concepts down right at the academic level so that when people are passing out and graduating from their respective institutions, they have a very clear idea of what the impacts are and how things could possibly be done to reduce those impacts? You cannot manage a situation which you're not aware of. So, you know, you need to get more aware. You need to understand what's happening around you and the impacts that you are having as an individual, as well as what our governments are doing in terms of addressing climate change.
That was from the middle of this episode, where our guest talks about the need to be more aware of our actions and how Carbon Initiative Forum is helping create that awareness at the grassroots level. Hello and welcome to yet another episode of the Mission Chunya podcast. As always, I have another interesting story followed by simple action items to help you transition to a sustainable lifestyle on this episode. Also, do stick around as always until the end of the show. I have an interesting and an easy action item towards getting to net zero. Passion is one common unifying theme with all the guests featured on this podcast, and today's guest is no different. He is part of the founding team of VNV Advisory and has helped implement multiple projects in the sustainability space. In addition to the work at VNV, he also got started with another passion project, the Carbon Initiative Forum. So, who's our guest for the show?
Hi, I'm Sandeep, Sandeep Roy Chaudhary. I am a director with VNV Advisory Services. It's a company that works with climate change and communities. I'm also a founding member of a nonprofit called Carbon Initiative Forum, where we work with climate change education for the youth.
Sandeep, let's start with your story and the reason. Why did you start VNV Advisory and how has the journey been so far?
Well, the journey's been quite exciting. This story, when VNV started, it was a group of people who started VNV. It wasn't just me. But I kind of happened to it by chance. And this is, we're talking about 2007, 8, maybe about 12, 13 years back. So yeah, I mean, it was a bit by chance. I was in a completely different sector looking at different, I was in human resources actually, which is quite different from what I'm doing now over the last decade or so. So yeah, it was by chance and it happened to be a great idea, I thought, which is basically trying to work with sustainability and climate change. So it was quite a very new thing back then. It wasn't really in normal discourse as much as it is today. So it was quite difficult when it started. I would assume I was one of the founders, so I wasn't the only one. But we started with a bit of work around energy access for rural households and the works, but it was quite difficult going for the first 2 years or so. But yeah, I mean, things started picking up after that, because, you know, climate became quite the theme starting 2009, 10 maybe, and moving ahead. So yeah, it's been an exciting journey. We did a lot of work with, with energy access for villages which did not have electricity. That was something that was quite big on our agenda when we first started. And then we moved from renewable energy for rural applications to what we call as clean cooking, where we were working with households. I mean, when we say we were working with, we work with partners who then work with communities. And we kind of worked quite heavily on biogas to cooking, which is basically using cow dung and your household waste to convert it into cooking gas, which is probably one of our flagship programs that we worked with. And we managed to reach almost, 200,000 odd households with that, in the last 5-6 years or so. And that was one of our programs that we really, what got us really excited and kind of set the template for us to then work in different other areas. So it was energy access, then cooking gas, then moved a lot into sustainable agriculture and what we call as social forestry. And, you know, these other dimensions kind of came in. But that typically gave us the kind of template then to replicate across different geographies, projects. You know, we started with just one country. Now we operate in over 9 countries in South Asia, Southeast Asia. So yeah, it's been an exciting journey so far. And now it's actually looking quite as if we are finally going to make some impact.
That really sounds fantastic. I'm sure it's just the tip of the iceberg. And as you have scaled up, I'm sure it's just about to get better. So looking at the kind of projects, as you said, you have worked on energy access, clean cooking, and then moved up to sustainable agriculture. And I also believe you do kind of financing for climate resiliency projects and many such projects. I mean, if someone looks at your website, they will find a lot of interesting projects. I'm sure there will be some projects that are on top of your mind. Can you give us a particular project, or can you explain something about a particular project where you offered an end-to-end solution and how you went about it?
Sure. I mean, I wouldn't call it an end-to-end solution. That sounds like a very consultancy thing, but I would rather go with, look, what excites us is innovative financing. The problem with climate is that it affects people substantially. So while we can keep worrying about the planet, I think the people who are affected by them need more help than that. I think the planet is going to be there, whether we are there or not. So to a large extent, the work is trying to get, when you say resilience, you have to get the people who are vulnerable from climate change, you know, and try and insulate them as much as you can try. Of course, you can't completely insulate them. But if you ask me about a particular project, I think I would go with the agriculture piece that we're working on and have been working on for a while, which is basically, you know, farmers are losing crops. Water is very, very rare to find these days, especially in India. And not just in India, actually, this is across the region. You know, so water is a problem. The soil fertility has gone down, to absolutely 90% degraded in a lot of areas in India. And that is something that worries us. And that's something that we have been trying to work with different partners. When I say different partners, we work with a lot of NGOs and different development agencies, etc. I've been trying to put our heads together in terms of how can we make this easier for the farmers. So one is, of course, water management. So you have different technologies on water management. You can budget water, you can do recharging, but all of it takes a lot of time. It's nothing there is no quick fix solution. And also you need to take out use of, you know, dirty energy in terms of, you know, water access, you know, these guzzling diesel pumps that people use, et cetera, et cetera. So you need a kind of, solution which takes care of energy access for the farmer. And why does a farmer need energy to draw water? Number two, where does he draw water from if he does not have water? And number three, if he does have water, how can he use it better? So these three things are on the water and energy front. And then you have the soil part to look after in terms of how much can the soil grow and, you know, kind of what we call as per acre productivity has to increase for the farmers to really, really make their ends meet. Forget about making money, you know. So those things are something that have been very challenging, I would say, for us. Now, the thing is, typical donor-based finance does not work because it needs to be long-term and it needs to be sustainable. Like I said, you can't recharge a water table over a period of 1 or 2 years. You need a lot more time. Nor can you recharge an entire soil system of farmers in 1-2 years' time. So our model is basically trying to incentivize farmers, because when we say farmers, they need to transition to cleaner practices. You need to reduce the use of pesticides. You need to manage your water better. You know, fertilizer use needs to be regulated and so on and so forth. This, you know, this transitioning is, farmers are very happy to do it, but then they will need to be compensated for it or incentivized for it. So we have come up with different models where we use different climate finance mechanisms, which are long-term mechanisms, which are 10-year mechanisms per year payments. So to kind of give access of credit to the farmer in terms of farmer producer organizations or farmer groups, where they can access working capital. They need that working capital at a subsidized interest rate of sorts because of climate financing coming in. Then they're getting some kind of equipment and processing centers, as well as energy access, when I say, you know, solar pumps and so on and so forth, which helps them get water in a cleaner manner. All of that put together is something that we have been successfully doing. And I think that's something that we are quite happy about. So, you know, that basically is climate resilience in our book, when farmers can kind of go towards a more climate resilient cropping pattern, have market linkages, be able to access capital when they need it, be able to sell their produce at a good price, not just sell their produce at a distressed price. You know what I mean? When farmers sometimes have the produce and the price is really low, they just have to sell because that's the way they would probably earn their livelihoods. But we're trying to make an ecosystem which does not necessarily need them to sell immediately and to have kind of other credit and financial mechanisms that kind of plug in at different levels. And all of these groups also having micro lending and the works within their own communities as well, for other alternatives to just agriculture. Maybe it's livestock rearing. It could be, you know, other forms of, you know, things that need to be done. And these kind of programs also have skill-based training and so on and so forth. Not that everybody in the family has to do farming. Somebody can, and somebody else maybe learns an electrician job or something like that. All of this is connected to climate resilience in a lot of ways. So that's something that, you know, if you ask me for a particular project, that's something that we would be quite, yeah, it's taken years, but I think it's finally falling into place for us. And we're already working with over, I don't know, about 50 to 60,000 odd farmers, and trying to plug these gaps.
Wow. That's a pretty big number, a pretty big community that you're supporting. That's wonderful.
Well, India is a big country.
True. Now, if I were to rephrase and say, rather than say end to end, I mean, all the projects, all the support that you offer the farming community, farmers, I'm sure this requires a dedicated follow-up and continuous tracking, monitoring, evaluation.
It does.
So how do you go about doing that over a period?
Well, technology is important. It can't be. This is a challenge, Girish, to be honest. The continuous monitoring, because we need to do a monitoring system, which is, like I said, these are 10-year programs. One is obviously community-based monitoring. A lot of the farmer groups themselves monitor a lot of the activities.
Nice.
You know, they do their own monitoring in terms of the groups are then subdivided into sub-working groups, and each group nominates one person who will be then monitoring for the group and then reporting back. We're putting in places in terms of apps and kind of putting in some technology into place as well, wherein the reporting could be electronic to a large extent. Obviously, internet connectivity is still a problem, which is, again, sorting itself out. Every year that we go back to certain areas, they seem to have more connectivity. So I would assume that that's something that that is going to be taken care of in the future. But yeah, the idea is, obviously, there's a high level of monitoring and reporting. But we are looking very seriously at the use of technology for that. In fact, there is, within precision farming, there is this, we can potentially, we're not using them right now, Girish, but maybe in potentially big data and AI could be playing a big part in monitoring large programs like these. As of now, it's basically community level monitoring. We are just trying to digitalize, so to speak, that piece. But if we can somehow manage to get chip-based technology and getting in, you know, other kind of predictive analytics into the picture, it would be great. And we're looking at that quite seriously.
That's nice. I'm sure as time passes by, I mean, every year the technology gets better, and I'm sure it will just be a matter of time before you can digitalize the entire transaction.
Yeah, we can still do it, Girish. It's just the costs are a little prohibitive. So if the costs are something that are more rational, then it will make sense. Because these programs run on very tight budgeting systems, you know. So to just add in a component of technology is not as easy as just putting it out there. Because these are not research-based projects. These are actually live projects happening on the ground.
Exactly.
That's something that we are looking at very closely. And like you said, technology is picking up. So we would see this developing. Yeah.
Sandeep, the other thing when someone looks at the kind of projects, the work that you do, you always, I'm sure in the conversation so far, you mentioned it a few times about climate resiliency. And you also track the impact every project has in terms of the sustainable development goals. So how did this idea come about, now where you quantify each project by saying like this project has this impact on goals 1, 2, 3, or how did this idea come about?
Actually, for us, look, I mean, the whole philosophy of our work has been with people. And it's more development work than anything else. Climate is actually a derivative of it all.
Correct.
You know, market linkages for farmers, livelihoods, you know, water management, you know, what we do with coastal forestry and so on and so forth are more livelihood projects than actual climate. Climate is a byproduct of all of this. An important one, yes, but it is a byproduct. So for us, I mean, the MDGs were there and then the SDGs came about. So, but all our projects typically would touch upon one or, I mean, several of them at any given point of time. So for us, it's not about reporting whether my project ticks the boxes of 1, 9, 12 or so on and so forth, but taking each parameter and seeing what impact have you made on that parameter. So for us, it's not just about mentioning that, you know, I have gender equality in my projects, you know. To what extent and how is that progressively going on? So with our projects, we basically have a protocol. We also do something called an SROI, a social return on investment, because it's not always an economic return that you get from your projects. You get a social return as well. And that for us quantifies SDGs, quantifies everything and say, what value for your buck did you get from this project? Not in terms of an IRR, from a financial perspective, but a social perspective. You know, what did this lead to? Did this lead to more jobs? Did this lead to more education? If it did, what kind of quality of education did it lead to, and so on and so forth. So for us, SDG quantification is not a tick box routine, and we're not necessarily fans of that either. It's more of even if it's two SDGs, what impact did you make on those two SDGs and follow that up quite rigorously for the next 10 years. That makes more sense than to just tick off SDGs. So like I said, most of the projects, because there is a community angle to climate, which is very, very, very ingrained in the kind of work that we do, we would typically say that we would tick off most SDGs at any given point of time with most of our projects. So yeah, so the reporting is more on the impact per SDG and not necessarily looking at it from the numbering perspective of the SDGs. Is of course, I mean, we would tick off climate action number 13 always. It's the rest of it that kind of goes around.
I like the way that you put it. It's not a tick box exercise for you. It's rather the impact that you see on the ground and then probably assess it that way. That's nice because a lot of projects, fortunately or unfortunately, just go by the tick box mentality and go through that filter.
It's not because our projects are not based on ticking SDGs. I mean, it's not. And it needs to be sustainable. It needs to be long-term because that's how the projects are designed. And these are all incentivized projects, result-based financing. You will not achieve results unless the communities are happy. So you'll have to do what you'll have to do to make sure that the impacts are seen on the ground. And if they are not, 4 or 5 years later, there is nothing to really, the communities have lost confidence in you. So there's nothing much you can do.
Perfect. Now, Sandeep, now shifting gears, you did speak about all the kind of projects that you do and you're involved in through VNV, but you work outside of VNV as well, do a lot of other activities through the Carbon Initiative Forum.
Yes.
How did this come about? And I mean, why did you feel the need to start another project when you were already immersed with a lot of other projects?
No, look, this is what we do for work. But being in this field, you can't help that the fact that, you know, there needs to be scale. And as much as the scale that we can reach with VNV, all of this is, climate resilience of vulnerable communities, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, at the end of the day, there needs to be larger change, which I don't think we can bring about. So the idea, this was more out of personal interest, Girish, because the whole thing was all that we're doing right now is always going to be a losing battle unless, you know, there is a whole scale change of the system per se, you know, in the sense that things like consumerism, things like fossil fuel generation, things like policy
will affect this region significantly. And all that we are doing, is making it easier, but it's a losing battle unless there is a whole scale change from individuals, and from such high populations like countries like ours. Because we can do whatever you want to do with the coastal communities and farmers and so on and so forth. This problem is not going to go away, is it? And somehow, if this problem has to go away or at least make it a little easier, millions of people have to contribute. So then how does that work? I mean, so for me, it was more out of personal interest. There is no financial, expectation or anything out of that. It's just the fact that of going around and doing this for the last decade or so, I have seen that there is a lot of misinformation. I wouldn't say misinformation, there's lack of information that exists within our academic circles, as well as the youth of the country. And that worries me to some extent, because we have broken down climate change into local issues, which is basically environmental issues. So while everybody understands air pollution and your lakes foaming, nobody understands, but very few people understand the larger impacts that all our lifestyles are bringing on to the planet. And the byproduct of that are these people who are suffering. So what we do in our cities specifically is quite detrimental to people who don't live in cities. And how many of us really give that a thought, in terms of our day-to-day living? And also the fact that, going around a lot of academic institutions, I realize that there is a deep lack of understanding of climate change and climate policies. While everybody understands what global warming is, there is no understanding of things like, country-based commitments at the global level. The very fact that India right now is the third largest emitter in the world is lost somewhere in translation for a lot of people. If you ask an average 12th grader of what he thinks about climate change, I don't think they would know much, in terms of the policies, in terms of what is existing and what as a country do we have to do and what as individuals can we do to contribute less to global warming or climate change, so to speak. And that was the gap that I saw. And not just me and us as specific, I mean, there are other organizations as well who see this gap. And I think there's a consortium now building up, which says basically that people who are studying, because this impacts us all, regardless of where we are, whether we are in Bangalore, Mumbai, or, in Kalahandi for that matter, it'll impact us all. So, we might as well know a little bit more about it. So the idea is to educate people more, and also to have, the end goal is to have climate policy as something that we, have in regular curriculums across schools, colleges, management schools. We went to a lot of management schools, for example. We want this to be not even an elective, but everybody needs to know about it while they're studying your finance and management systems and so on and so forth. So that was the idea. I mean, it's a very small beginning. Let's see how that goes.
Big idea, start small. So that's a good start.
Hopefully.
You didn't mention about going to educational institutions, schools, even management schools. So I believe institutions are one of the stakeholders, but who are the other partners that you mentioned who are collaborating with you on this pursuit?
No, so we basically, the first collaboration are academic institutes, because our target focus is the age group of about 14 to 25. Because I think these are the people who will bear the brunt of all of this, first of all. And secondly, our first focus was management education, because we think that these are people who will get into positions of influence in future, and they should be able to influence their organizations that they join or their new startups that they start, to have these kind of things inbuilt into their business. Sustainability, it makes business sense. It's de-risking your business. So how do you get these concepts down right at the academic level so that when people are passing out and graduating from their respective institutions, they have a very clear idea of what the impacts are and how things could possibly be done to reduce those impacts. So that's one of the biggest stakeholders, like you mentioned. And number two would be different kinds of organizations that work on the same area. you know, different kinds of civil society organizations. And number three would be corporates, because we are planning to also hold town halls across corporates with their employees and have people of influence who talk to them and say, look, guys, we need to get more aware. You cannot manage a situation which you're not aware of. So, you know, you need to get more aware. You need to understand what's happening around you, and the impacts that you are having as an individual, as well as what our governments are doing in terms of addressing climate change. And how could we possibly hold them accountable for it? Not in terms of an activism perspective, but at least knowing. I mean, how many people actually know what our country commitments are in the global landscape on climate change? I don't think many people know that. You know, so it's all on your phone these days, isn't it? It's just a Google search away. But how many people actually do that? So that's the idea. So I think three major stakeholders would be obviously academic institutions. Number two, other civil society organizations like ours, like Carbon Initiative Forum. And number three would be businesses. And finally, lastly, most importantly, it'll be the individuals. I think they are the biggest stakeholders in this play. As such, you know, normal individuals like you and me.
Perfect. It leads me right well into my next question. I'm sure people who listen to the podcast or anywhere they find about this, they'll be itching to know, like, how can I contribute or be part of this? So what is the best way that they can contribute to this? I'm sure there must be some simple ways also that you have conceptualized.
Well, it's still a work in progress, Girish, I have to be honest. But our first step is to make people aware of the climate change education part. Number two is to get climate change policy education into the textbooks, wherever it may be, regardless of courses. And because, like I said, it's cross-cutting. You know, it cuts across whether you're studying medicals or engineering. It doesn't matter. It will impact you in some way or the other. So our first step is that. And what can individuals do? Basically, our first step, like I said, is to educate them. Number two is for them to understand their impacts a little bit more. When I say their impacts, it could be as a group, it could be as a corporate, it could be as an institution, it could be as them, as people. We have these calculators which are on the website where they can go see their water footprint. They can calculate their carbon footprint. They can track their carbon footprint to decide, you know, how they are possibly reducing it over a period of time. Also to understand their and overall impacts. When I said water footprint, a lot of us don't realize how much water we actually use. And to bring that on a scientific platform where I can actually track, you know, and understand that when I take a shower, what does it mean, is a good first step, I would assume. And also, you know, within that educative process, we want to put in things of basic consumerism. You know, the very fact that we change our phones every 2 years isn't the most healthiest thing. But how many people actually even think about that in terms of, you know, the impact that that brings? Where does this phone go? So we want to educate people on that and then leave it to people to judge and decide on them on what they want to do. But our point is to get them more aware, if you know what I mean. It's not for us to completely give you all the solutions. But once you're more aware, you actually start ideating on your own. And that's the idea. I mean, people are intelligent, but you need to feed them the right information that can make them then think and go towards a path which reduces impacts. Because different people will do it in different ways. But just say that, look, if you're buying this car and you're driving this around, this is what the impact it has. If you are buying this phone and you're throwing away this phone again, this is the impact it has. Now it's up to you to decide how you want to look at your life and try and make that difference. Or look at your life, or for an organization, it could be something else. But that's the idea here, is to make people more aware of different kinds of things in terms of life cycle impacts of certain products that we use. The cup of coffee that we drink, where does it come from? The fabric that you're wearing, that cotton, where does it come from? And what are the impacts it has had over the supply chain of that particular product? So our idea is to just make you aware of that. Now, whether you want to throw away 50% of your garments or stop shopping, that's up to you. But we will just tell you what the impact it has, you know, and that's our idea. And I think I go back to the fact that people are intelligent. If you give them the overall picture and break it down for them in terms of what it means to do and go about our lives as we are and change that measure of success, if you will, in the sense that you don't have to own a big car and a big house to be perceived as successful, is a very important thing that needs to be drilled out, you know? And But those are personal choices. We are just giving you the information, you know, and what you do with that information is up to you. But we will try and give you as much information for you to make an educated call, basically. So that's our idea.
Sandeep, that was wonderfully put. I totally take that point, because with better awareness, people can make better choices and that will have better results in the future. So that's wonderfully put. And the idea of making them more aware is wonderful, spot on. Now, Sandeep, on a final note, you have been in the space for more than a decade, worked with VNV and now with the Carbon Initiative Forum. I'm sure it's still early according to you, but how do you rate the journey so far or the impact that it's had on the space? How do you rate the impact of your work in the space?
Well, I mean, it's been a good journey, Ganesh, I have to say. We have made significant impact. I mean, as VNV, I mean, we work with over 5 million odd households. We work with over 70,000, 80,000 hectares of different kinds of forests and agricultural farms, etc. So the impact has been decent, but it's still a drop in the ocean, really, if you look at what needs to be done. With CIF, that's Carbon Initiative Forum, it's fairly new. It's what, about 2-3 years old. It will take some more time to really see if we can make. But our idea is to make impact on both ends, because both are equally important. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to rate the impact per se, because I do think that a lot of everything that we're doing is a drop in the ocean. It won't make a dent unless there is a economy-wide change across. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think we would be too keen on rating the impact. But it's been good so far. We've done whatever we can in our little way. But hopefully, you know, and there are other people who are doing great jobs as well. I mean, great work. So, yeah, it's been a good journey. And hopefully we can make some more impacts over the next decade or so. Let's see. Because we don't have much time, do we? That's another issue.
We definitely don't have much time. But yeah, it's been a wonderful story to hear about your work. And I'm sure a lot of people will probably feel motivated to do their bit, at least be more aware of what they are doing and probably act a little more responsibly. I'm sure like mighty drops like this, whatever we do, will have a bigger impact some point in the future. So Sandeep, good luck with all your future endeavors, all the future projects. Thanks for taking time to join me on the podcast.
No worries. Thanks, Ganesh. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation I had with Sandeep. As you would admit, Sandeep has had quite an impact in this space and is actively looking to make even bigger contributions. The links to connect with Sandeep and to know more about the Carbon Initiative Forum, check the show notes section of this episode or the webpage for this episode on missionjunior.com. Now on to this week's action item towards Mission Junior. Well, it's quite easy. While you visit the website of Carbon Initiative Forum, please take time to check the Carbon Footprint Calculator, an easy tool that is available right on the homepage. By providing accurate inputs of all your activities, you can estimate your carbon footprint, and from there, you can try to minimize the impact. If you are a business owner, you can probably get a detailed assessment done through the links from the website. So do check that out and let me know how you felt after using the tool. Of course, you can provide your feedback to me directly. Just send an email to missionchunia@gmail.com or tag missionchunia, the handle is @missionchunia across Facebook, Instagram or Twitter. And before we sign off, make sure you have subscribed to the show, because I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with yet another podcast episode. And if you like the show, do give a rating, write a review or share it with friends, family and colleagues so that more people are aware of the show. It takes only about 30 seconds to share the episode link with 3 people in your network. So please consider doing that. So signing off, this is Girish Shivakumar, and as always, thank you for listening.